This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. On October the 1st, Wallace Jefferson became the former Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court. The San Antonio native had been on the state's high civil court since 2001 when he was appointed by Governor Rick Perry, and then again Perry appointed him to be the Chief Justice in 2004. Since then, he won election to the court every 6 years. In that time, Jefferson worked to make the high courts more transparent, putting video cameras in their proceedings, putting documents online, simplifying the court documents for us non-lawyers so we could understand them, working to improve access to justice, being an advocate for public defenders, working to reform issues of juvenile justice, and also trying to do something about the public school to prison pipeline. He also worked on thorny issues of electing judges in Texas. We're going to focus on that particularly in the second half hour. But first, I need to welcome our guest, the Honorable Chief Justice Wallace B. Jefferson. Welcome to The Source.
It's great to be here.
So, Mr. Chief Justice, let me ask you, you stepped down on October the 1st, and we have a government shutdown. I think that's related somehow.
Cause and effect. Exactly.
So what is it like not to be the top guy in Texas for justice?
Well, I knew I would miss being Chief Justice of Texas. And although it's only been a week, I do miss it. I have not been sitting in on oral arguments like I would normally be doing, or engaging with the legislature on things that are important to Texans in the administration of justice. But I'd been on the court 12 years, and 12 years is a good amount of time for public service. And it seemed to me that this was about the appropriate juncture to take on a new challenge in life. If I hadn't left now, I would have been right now campaigning again. And we'll talk about that later, but that's not the most pleasant activity in the world.
Exactly. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question for the Mr. Chief Justice, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. You can also email questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. I want to get in a little bit into your background. First, you're native of San Antonio, John Jay High School. But further than that, you know, your roots in Texas. Tell us about that.
That's great. I was born in Tacoma, Washington, actually. My father was in the United States Air Force. And from Washington State, we moved to Guam, and then from Guam to San Antonio, right before Hemisphere. So when I was campaigning, they all said, well, you weren't even born in Texas, which is a very, very harsh indictment. So I told this story. My father and I, when I was in law school in 1985, went to the Texas State Archives and looked up our family history. His mother was born in Palestine, Texas. Her great-grandfather was from Waco, Texas. We found his obituary, and it said, Shedrick Willis, well-known slave, dies in 1903. And it says, after the Civil War, he served on the Waco City Council for two terms. And it said, before the war, he was owned by Judge Nicholas W. Battle. So he was a slave who was owned by a state judge. And now, almost 150 years later, his descendant rose to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Texas. It is a great irony in my mind.
And so your grandmother was from Palestine in East Texas, and then she ended up in Chicago.
Correct.
And then your father was in the Air Force, and then you became with him and back here to Texas.
Yes, it's very interesting. He was in intelligence. He was born in Chicago, raised in Milwaukee, and then he joined the Air Force in 1952. Where did that take him first? Right here to San Antonio, Lackland Air Force Base for basic training. And then over the years, he got 2 degrees, an undergraduate degree, a master's degree from St. Mary's University. And after traveling all over the world, settled in San Antonio when he was stationed at Kelly Air Force Base. So this is home for me. I've gone to elementary school here all the way through high school. My mother
public
still
schools.
Lives here. All public schools, including college and law school.
And so now you Rick Perry appoints you to – so why you? Why did Rick Perry reach out to you?
I didn't know Governor Perry or anyone in his office, and I have pieced together what happened. Two things happened. One was a good friend of mine who's an African-American lawyer was Governor Perry's general counsel when Al Gonzalez stepped down from the court, creating the vacancy.
And so that was because, you know, Governor George W. Bush became president, and he picked his man, Alberto Gonzalez, to come work with him in the White House.
That's right. And the other person who I knew well was then Attorney General John Cornyn. And I remember being at home one day and got a call from then Attorney General Cornyn saying, the governor's office is going to be calling you. Make sure you answer the phone. And so I answered. They invited me up to Austin, where I met with the governor and had a very long conversation with him about the administration of justice, about our own family backgrounds and history. He wanted to know about my appellate experience. I'd argued before the U.S. Supreme Court and the Texas Supreme Court. Twice, exactly, before the U.S. Supreme Court. And ultimately, he asked me to serve and to run. And so my first run for public office was in 2001 with the election in 2002.
So you become the Chief Justice. Eventually, he appoints you on the court, and then 3-4 years later, appoints you Chief Justice. And then you also become what, president of the Chief Justice Association, the National Association, and so right. so a national voice for judicial.
Yes, so I was president of the Conference of Chief Justices, and in that capacity worked with Chief Justice John Roberts, worked with Eric Holder and all the chiefs of the states and the territories on policy that impacts the administration of justice. And that was exciting because, you know, obviously I and members of the court have an impact on Texas law, but this gave us an opportunity to have a conversation with all of our citizens throughout the country on the proper administration of justice.
And it's interesting that you're able to highlight things that are happening in Texas, and when you were able to talk to them in a national audience, and people were looking to, I mean, Texas was actually being a leader in many areas.
Right. Yeah, we were a leader in working with the legislature to get direct funding for legal aid programs. We were a leader, one of probably the third or fourth large state, to create a permanent commission on children, youth, and families to make sure that kids who are removed from the home through no fault of their own because of abuse or neglect find a way to permanency, back home again if that's appropriate, or through adoption. We've done a lot to advance policy in Texas that has been adopted throughout the country.
We're speaking with Mr. Chief Justice, the former Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, Wallace Jefferson. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. If you want to join the conversation, we invite your phone calls. Numbers 614-8980, 614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org or comment directly on our website at tpr.org. We will be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In the studio, former Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, Wallace Jefferson, is with us. So let me ask you, Mr. Chief Justice, you've really taken a look at the issue of juvenile justice. That is one of the issues that the Texas Supreme Court deals with, is juvenile justice in the Texas state of Texas. And you've tried to make it, I don't know if this is less harsh, but more understanding or less trying to just, if a person breaks a rule, that we just don't ostracize someone from society, that you're trying to, maybe I'm phrasing it wrong. What were you trying to do?
No, I think that's right. I decided a few years ago to visit a juvenile justice courtroom and see what actually goes on, because I had never personally handled juvenile justice cases as a lawyer, and yet I'm seeing these cases come before the Supreme Court. So I sat in on proceedings. And one thing that I noticed was a lot of these kids that are in trouble have mental health issues. And the judges and all the staffers there are saying, we don't have the resources to really tackle this problem for these kids. The second thing I saw was many kids were in trouble for violations of school codes of conduct. Things like disrupting class, or cursing at the teacher, or minor fights that didn't involve violence, didn't involve any serious injury, the kind of things that would have landed you and me in the principal's office. Well, now they're being ticketed by school police officers for this sort of conduct. Maximum $500 fines that they can't pay, and they have to appear in municipal court to try to defend against these. But there's no time, as you've mentioned, to defend yourself against these, and you're not represented by counsel. So I and many others thought it was time to take a look at the way we were disciplining our kids through the criminal justice system. It seemed like it didn't make much sense.
So we were able to track the data and show that children who drop out of school, one of the signs, red flags, is that they were getting a lot of these tickets, and they were being driven into this system, and which was off campus. You would have this enforcement officer on campus, and he would issue these tickets, which is actually like a ticket, like if you speeding ticket, and end up in a municipal court, and then it would be very disruptive to a family, and maybe, you know, the kid would decide it's not even worth for me to go back to school.
That's right. And the study also showed that by far those who were receiving these tickets for these discretionary violations were either minority or those with mental disabilities. Now, for the non-discretionary violations, like bringing a gun on campus or a knife, they studied those disciplinary actions. And there was virtually no discrimination between minorities and Anglos. And so something was going on where teachers and school districts had discretion for these minor violations. And it was in a way that made minorities and those with mental health problems far more likely to get a ticket. And then, as you say, far more likely to eventually drop out of school and become part of the criminal justice system.
We're going to go to the phone lines. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Let's get Michael B. on the line. Michael B., welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Mr. Davies and Mr. Chief Justice, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Welcome.
I just wanted to say it's good to hear Wallace on the radio again. And Chief Justice Jefferson, everybody needs to know, was an outstanding lawyer in San Antonio and in the legal profession and the judiciary. We're all very proud of him. Not only for his work on the court, of course, and throughout the nation, but also for his prior work in San Antonio, and hopes he continues to call San Antonio home and does a lot of good work here, too, as well. Also, you need to know that Chief Justice Jefferson, I don't know if you touched on this before, argued two cases successfully in front of the United States Supreme Court and prevailed, too. And so, but the question is, Mr. Chief Justice, what is it that you see as the greatest challenges for the judiciary and the legal profession going forward, including pro se litigants, which the court had an initiative about recently in the family law arena, and also number two, going forward, what is it that you are going to be doing in private practice?
All right. Thank you, Michael B. Thanks for that phone call.
Well, thank you very much. Very flattering. I will always call San Antonio home. Let me just make that clear. I think the greatest challenge going forward is the expensiveness of the justice system. Most people cannot afford to hire a lawyer to represent them successfully. The system costs too much. And I'm not talking just about indigent or poor Texans. I'm talking about the middle class and upper middle class. We simply can't afford a lawyer. And courts need to do something about this, and the legal profession needs to do something about it. We need to shine a light on ourselves. What do you do? Well, you increase the use of forms. So people who don't understand the law necessarily don't have an obstruction to being able to present their case to a court or to a jury. You increase pro bono representation. That means encouraging lawyers to represent people for free of charge. We are a blessed profession, and perhaps we have an obligation to give back to our community. You try to get the legislature involved. The legislature, through direct appropriation, can help legal aid organizations provide needed resources to people like veterans. Veterans who are having difficulty receiving the benefits that the country owes them by virtue of their service, but it takes months or years for those benefits to come through. Perhaps a lawyer can help accelerate that process, or people who are exposed to domestic violence and can't afford a lawyer to get a restraining order. Well, we should provide people lawyers to get restraining orders if they can't get it otherwise. If justice is unaffordable, justice is denied, and I think we're a better state and country than that.
But we have so many lawyers now. I mean, the number of lawyers per individual in society is just staggering. Why is it so expensive?
Well, because in many of our law firms, a first-year lawyer, their compensation is around $170,000 a year.
That's what you were making as the Chief Justice.
Yes, but that's what they're making coming straight out of law school. And with that sort of compensation, you know, if you try to pass that on to mom and pop, they simply are not going to be able to afford the hourly fee. The other thing is we need to capture some of these lawyers who are coming out and encourage them to do legal aid work or work at a reduced fee so that they're available for a greater proportion of our citizenry.
Isn't there a fund, IOLTA, which captures interest of money that was set into escrow accounts? And that money was being used to pay for legal aid for the indigent.
That was the primary source, but it was dependent on the federal interest rate, the Federal Reserve interest rate, which today is about zero. So although that was the primary source of funding in 1984 when that program was created, now it is barely making ends meet. So another source of funding is the Legal Services Corporation in Washington, D.C., but Congress has cut that pretty dramatically in the last several sessions. And so now we are relying on lawyers to give of their time for free, and also we've asked the legislature to give a direct appropriation to access to justice programs. And they did, and I'm proud of them for it. They did it when the economy in Texas was suffering. They did it the next session when the economy was suffering even more, because they understood that when the economy is bad, that's when those who are less fortunate, that's when their problems are really profound. And I'm proud of what they did, and I'm proud the governor supported this effort in each of the last three sessions.
When you ran for your place on the court, you had to run on a partisan ticket. You ran as a Republican. But, you know, you don't sound like a Republican when you're talking about some of the issues of trying to help the indigent and the poor. Am I just being harsh? Tell me about that.
Well, I don't think it's fair to look at this issue in partisan terms. And when I said I was proud of the legislature, guess what? They were both Republican chairs and Democratic chairs. Republican members of the House and Senate, and Democratic members of the House and Senate who came together on this effort. And in fact, two sessions ago, a joint resolution of the House and Senate commended the Supreme Court of Texas for pursuing legal aid for our poor citizens. Now, that's a House and a Senate controlled by Republicans, and yet Democrats and Republicans joined together saying this is the right course for Texas to pursue. We've raised a lot of eyebrows across the nation because a lot of people thought, no, Republicans are conservatives, and conservatives mean you don't want to help those who are in need. But I think we've proved that not to be true, at least here.
We're going to get another phone call on the air. This is another Michael. Michael, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. First of all, let me say I'm very pleased to talk with you, Justice Jefferson. Your brother Glenn and I were classmates at Poe Junior High years ago, so very nice to see a kid off the east side really go a long way and have a great career. Besides that, I'm going to San Antonio College and Texas A&M University. And the professor over at San Antonio College, Dr. Michael Berrien, mentioned last week, that you had made some comments concerning the criminal justice system and some work that needed to be done in that area. I responded to him by bringing him a copy of a case called Meschel versus State, which years ago showed that the Texas Speedy Trial Act had been declared unconstitutional. And the question, of course, would be, was that consequently problematic for the criminal justice system?
All right, let's get an answer for that. Thank you for that call, Michael.
Well, I'll say this. You know, my court only hears civil cases, but I've been pretty emphatic that we need reform in the criminal justice system. And so I've called for several years now for some way for the state to look at why we have exonerated so many men, primarily, who've spent decades in prison for crimes they didn't commit, who were exonerated because DNA later proved them to be innocent. I think that is a stain on our system of justice. We need to look at whether we are defending these criminal defendants appropriately. And so for the first time ever in Texas, a few years ago, we created a public defender's office in the largest county that in the nation that didn't have one, Harris County in Houston, Texas. And we have adopted regional public defender's offices in West Texas. So we're doing a whole lot to try to address what I think is a big problem.
You're listening to The Source on KSTX. With me in the studio is the former Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, Wallace Jefferson. We're going to continue in the next half hour talking about the issue that Texas judges are elected to the bench and what that means in terms of justice. And we're going to continue that conversation when we come back after this NPR news break. You're listening to The Source on KSTX.